Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thank you for joining me. We've spent the last two episodes talking about the Roman economy before and during the fall of the empire. I suggested that what made the complex and enormously productive Roman economy stand out among pre-modern economies more generally was a combination of a few things, including full monetization and price-setting commercial markets. The most distinctively Roman thing about the Roman economy, though, was the sheer scale of the movement of goods from place to place. Every economy since the Neolithic, and even earlier, has had room for long-distance trade of luxury items. But what set the Romans apart was the fact that they moved huge quantities of low-value bulk items from place to place. Grain, olive oil, wine, woolens, and pottery all moved around and beyond the Mediterranean world, linking Gaul in North Africa, Iberia and Italy, the Balkans and Britain, into a tight economic unit built on the roads and ports funded and maintained by the Roman state. But let's take a step back from this and consider the broader implications of all that movement. Sacks of grain didn't pick themselves up and cross the sea, travel upriver, or hop onto a cart to cross some mountains all on their own. It was people who were doing the moving, and the goods were just along for the ride. The Roman economy was just a reflection of, and helped to drive, the movement of huge numbers of people from place to place. One good, well-reasoned estimate suggests that roughly 40% of the Roman Empire's population would have moved a substantial distance from their places of birth over the course of their lives. For comparison, that's higher than the current lifetime rate of state-to-state migration in the United States, which is about 30%, and even after dropping in recent years, the United States' rate of internal migration is really high compared to most of the developed world. If that 40% estimate for the Roman Empire is correct, and I'd say there's good reason to believe that it is, then it helped to produce a level of personal mobility that wouldn't be matched for centuries to come. The implications of all that movement are staggering for understanding the culture and society of the Roman Empire. In today's episode, we're going to talk about what that level of mobility meant for the Roman world and how it fell apart. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is the Fall of Rome. The Roman Empire was fundamentally a space of movement. We've discussed at great length the movement of goods, and there were sailors and carters and boatmen and merchants who regularly made trips of various lengths from city to city and town to town for commercial purposes. They weren't the only ones moving, though. The ships, roads, ports, and rivers of the empire that carried trade goods also transported students traveling to intellectual centers, aristocrats and their entourages traveling from the city to one of their estates, slaves on their way to market, priests, craftsmen, and families. Above all, a vast array of people traveled on official business. Soldiers moved from post to post in huge numbers. Legal officials were itinerant by nature. Cities sent envoys to the imperial court, and the imperial court sent representatives to cities. And as we discussed at great length, the army had to be supplied. Now this might sound kind of basic, but we have to understand how different this situation was from what had come before and what would come after. Alexander the Great's conquests created a Hellenistic world of mobility that stretched from Greece to Afghanistan, and the tight connections of the Mediterranean world had existed for a millennium prior to the rise of the Roman Empire. There was still trade, even in the doldrums of the early Middle Ages, and pilgrims traversed the Mediterranean on their way to Rome and Jerusalem. What was different for the Roman Empire was the scale and depth of this movement. It wasn't just the major cities that were connected into broader networks, but even towns and villages. It wasn't just wealthy pilgrims heading to a religious center or merchants transporting a small quantity of high-value items, but large numbers of even humble people traveling for the short term or moving for good. All of this movement made the Roman Empire a fundamentally cosmopolitan place, one that's best understood as a global space in much the same way as we understand our own 21st century world. It featured complex series of cultural, social, economic, and political interactions between the particularities of the local context and the broader currents of Roman culture and society. Architecture, religion, education, even pottery making, all of them existed in broad patterns across the entire empire, and those things all expressed themselves in a diverse tapestry of fashions within the local communities that comprised the empire. Greek tutors taught grammar and rhetoric in rural villas in Britain. Syrian merchants sold their wares along the Rhine frontier. Goths born beyond the Danube joined the Roman army and fought Arab raiders along the fringes of the Syrian desert. North African priests advised Gallic bishops. Italian aristocrats owned estates in Spain and the Balkans. A Frankish noble turned Roman soldier could end his career as a top military advisor to the emperor in Ravenna. Those interactions and the cosmopolitan character of the empire weren't possible without the inherent mobility that its roads, ports, and general safety afforded. Without the internet or phones or the telegraph, for ideas or books or practices or beliefs or what have you to travel, people had to travel. That is how you make a world of shared culture, society, economy, and politics, through travel. Mobility in the Roman world took many forms. Individual or collective, forced or voluntary, peaceful or violent, legal or clandestine, temporary or permanent. But no matter what form it took, the Roman world was a particularly mobile space. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that mobility in the empire was ever totally free and uncontrolled at any point in its history. You might need official documents to move goods from one province to another, for example. But there's no getting around the fact that it was freer and less controlled than what came after by an enormous margin. Whatever documents were required for the movement of people and goods were far less of a check on mobility than instability, danger, and the rise of new internal borders that accompanied the fall of the Roman Empire. Ease of movement and communication were central to what had made the Roman world function as a coherent unit despite its inherent diversity, and disruptions in their function were central mechanisms in producing the vastly different world that came after. The increasing difficulty of movement and communication led directly to the regionalization of the post-imperial world, the kind of fracturing of the former unity that we've discussed over and over and over again in the course of this show. Now that's the argument I'm making anyways, and as luck would have it, I know a few things about this topic. That's because this, mobility and communication and how the fall of the Roman Empire affected them, was the subject of my doctoral dissertation. I spent about 5 years working on this, and not to go too far overboard, but I know more about this than all but a few people in the world. It's my specialty. So, how do we know this? How do we know that the end of the Roman Empire caused a breakdown of mobility and communications, which had created not just an empire, but a whole social, economic, and cultural world that we can call Roman? Now, I approach this topic through the lens of letters, through correspondence. Every period and every region has a particular type of source that, for whatever reason, is really common. For late medieval England, for example, it's legal rules from parishes or manors. For the early medieval Rhineland, it's monastic charters that record transactions of land related to a particular monastery. For most of the Roman Empire, it's inscriptions, or alternatively, as we've discussed, pottery sherds. For late antique Egypt, or for all of Egypt's history for that matter, it's papyrus documents. For late antiquity in the Western Empire, the characteristic source is letters. There are thousands of them, written by dozens of different authors in many different places, and their sheer quantity means that you can do a bunch of different things with them. I was already interested in these questions of mobility and communication, and to me it seemed that letters were the perfect source to give some insight into those questions. Why? Because think about what a letter really is. It's a crystallized journey, a journey frozen in time. Somebody had to take that letter from point A to point B. That person had to ride a horse or walk along a road, take a boat along a river, get on a ship at a port, or use some combination of all those methods. Every single letter tells us a huge amount about the world that produced it. It's a proxy marker for movement as a whole. Now, we have a couple of thousand letters written by popes, from Leo the Great, the pope who faced down Attila the Hun, to Gregory the Great, the pope who sent the first missions to the Anglo-Saxons in England and literally wrote the book on pastoral care of the Christian faithful. We have the letters of bishops in Gaul, Italy, and Spain on everything from doctrinal disputes to the marriages of their children. We have some of the diplomatic letters of the Frankish court, detailing their complicated relationship with the Eastern Emperor in Constantinople. My personal favorite collection, the one I know the most about, are the administrative letters of the Ostrogothic Kingdom in Italy, where we see Roman aristocrats working as government functionaries, much as their fathers and grandfathers had done for the imperial court located in exactly the same city, in Ravenna. To be clear, the body of letters that we have, while there are many of them, is nothing like the entirety of once existed. There are big chronological gaps, even among the copious papal letters. They don't cover every region, and northern Gaul, the Balkans, and Iberia are mostly unknown. Authors and later copyists made decisions about what to save and what to throw away. We don't have a single original letter on papyrus or parchment from the period I'm talking about, only collections copied into manuscripts centuries later. We don't have any letters from the West written by people who weren't among the elite. If you really want to go into detail about the benefits and limitations of letters as a source base, I can point you in the direction of a whole freaking chapter of my dissertation, so I don't want to dwell on it too much here. With all of that said, we still have thousands of letters, 3,000 to be exact, and they can all tell us something. If you think of every letter as a journey, then suddenly you have records of thousands of trips, and therefore a huge amount of insight into a mobile world that you could only see flashes of beforehand. Histories and chronicles and other kinds of written sources we have for this period tell us next to nothing about these questions. It's the same reason pottery is useful for understanding exchange networks. It's a proxy marker for mobility, and there's a ton of it, so you can build up a much more in-depth and detailed picture than you could from other sources. I went through every one of these letters and figured out where it was written, where it was sent to, when, and what route it took, how long it took, and who carried it. It was painstaking, boring, and difficult, not to oversell the case, but it was the basis for everything else that followed, for all of the conclusions that I'll be drawing over the course of today's episode. These thousands of journeys layer on top of each other, eventually giving you something like a detailed map of routes and regions and places that you can compare with what you find in other source bases, especially the exchange networks built from pottery that we've talked so much about in this show. So that was my original contribution here, the idea that letters can speak directly to the questions that we have about mobility and how it changed across this period. They're a direct window onto a whole world of mobile people that we would otherwise know nothing about. We see farmers, slaves, and humble deacons traveling along the roads, rivers, and seaways of the post-imperial West, not just the bishops and aristocrats and devout pilgrims we might expect to see. Moreover, we see a whole kind of travel, the kind of everyday, short or medium distance movement that binds the world together that everybody kind of took for granted in writing other kinds of sources. I'll give you a modern parallel for this. You might get really stoked to talk about your honeymoon in Hawaii or the Caribbean or Thailand or Greece or whatever, but you're probably not going to be as inclined to mention that business trip you took to Plano, Dubuque, Knoxville, or Yakima. You know what I mean? Those business trips are still really important, though. You still have to get on a plane, a train, or into a car. You still have to use the roads and airports. There has to be some place for you to stay when you get there. Now, which of those two things, travel for tourism or travel for business, do you think is a bigger and more important deal for a regional economy, society, and culture? Which of those makes up a regional world? That's what I was trying to get at here with letters. It's not just that they show you mobility and communication, but that they show you a kind of mobility and communication that's otherwise invisible. Now, we might assume that there were people moving relatively short distances on a regular basis, but it's impossible to prove that with any other kind of evidence that's available to us, because nobody cared enough to write about it. That short-distance, everyday movement creates a whole interconnected world out of a patchwork of islands, of villages, and towns and cities. But before we talk about the big picture of communication and mobility and how the fall of the Roman Empire changed them, let's meet a few of the real people these letters introduce us to. This was my favorite thing about working with these 3,000 texts for half a decade. Even if only in flashes, you could see some of the real people who lived and died during this time, and not just the authors themselves. At least for today's episode, we don't have to talk about hypothetical people to understand these changes, to ground them in real lived experience. We can talk about real people. So let me tell you about Calumniosus. In December of 591, Calamniosis set out from his hometown of Orvieto for Rome, traveling the 80-mile distance up and down the hills of Umbria on the ancient flagstones of the Via Cassia in the dead of winter. Calamniosis was on his way to see Pope Gregory the Great in the hope of receiving support from the church in Orvieto, support he was due as a sick man. You see, Calamniosis suffered from seizures, and the church authorities in Orvieto refused to support him, interpreting his affliction not as a sickness, but as divine judgment. Pope Gregory, though, he agreed with Calamniosis and sent him on his way back home with a letter ordering the church in Orvieto to give Calamniosis what he needed. In a letter of Sidonius Apollinaris, the bishop of Clermont in Gaul in the 470s, we meet a poor deacon who had fled the Auvergne region when the Goths invaded and ended up with his family in Auxerre. Now, this poor deacon made the mistake of sowing a crop of grain on land belonging to Bishop Censorius of Auxerre, which Censorius then demanded that he tithe to him instead of keeping to feed his family. Sidonius pleaded with Censorius to allow the deacon, whose name we never learn, to keep his crop. But we don't know what happened to that poor deacon and his family afterward. There are hundreds of snippets like these contained within the letters, and we'll come back to them again over the course of the episode.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they'll love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, your coworker, anyone you care about, what podcast they would really love. Got it? Now do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know about podcasts, show them how. Remind them they're free and right there on their phone. Tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod, TryPod. For Try a Podcast. Thanks so much for spreading the word. All right, so let's get back to letters, communication, and mobility. I'm going to run you through what I discovered about the broad patterns that went along with the fall, and we're going to meet some more real people and the journeys they took through their landscape of the post-imperial West. Finally, we'll talk a little bit about places and what this all means. Now, during the empire's heyday, travel had been easy and straightforward on local, regional, and trans-regional levels. The high level of economic integration that we talked about, all of those integrated markets that existed on those same local, regional, and trans-regional levels, created a tremendous hum of background movement that everything else built off of. The same ships that carried grain from North Africa to Rome also carried students heading to work with a specialist rhetorician or a bishop going to see the Pope. Boats heading up the Rhone from Arles to Lyon with cargoes of olive oil or pottery also carried itinerant farm laborers looking for work or priests on their way to a new post. A merchant transporting a load of wine from an estate in the countryside to Tarragona in Spain might also carry a clutch of letters from an aristocratic villa owner to his friend. Other types of travel could exist independently of trade, but for the most part, the two played off of and reinforced each other. None of this is to say that travel in the Roman Empire was completely free and uncontrolled. You might need documents to pass from one locality or province to another. We know that rural laborers, for example, had letters of recommendation from the owners of estates that they had worked for. Merchants had to pay taxes and customs duties. There were generally guards at the gates to cities. There was a great deal of trade and movement across the empire's borders, but that too was controlled, in some times and places more tightly than in others. Despite all of this, it wasn't difficult to travel. If you wanted to go from, say, Alexandria in Egypt to Rome, there were already ships making that journey, and you could just pay a passage to hop on board. If you wanted to go from Marseille to Reims, there were boats going up the Rhone and the other rivers of the Gallic interior. There were well-maintained roads, there were places to acquire horses, and there were facilities to accommodate travelers. If you were traveling on official business, you were in even better shape. There was a whole network of way stations with fresh horses, supplies, and places to stay studded along every major roadway of the empire. This system was called the cursus publicus, and it was maintained at official expense through the tax system. It wasn't a public postal system or anything like that, but if you were a government official or a messenger, you could move vast distances very quickly simply by changing horses at every way station and stopping only at night. The fastest journeys on the cursus publicus that we know about could cover as much as 160 miles in a day. A courier could depart the southern capital at Ravenna in Italy, cross the Alps, and reach the Gallic frontier capital at Trier in just about 5 or 6 days. That is an incredible speed of movement in the pre-modern world. As the Roman state fell, its economy slowly contracted, and new kingdoms popped up in what had once been the empire. This world of easy, extensive mobility likewise came apart at the seams. It was a lot harder to travel to Bordeaux from Rome in 500 than it had been in 400, and it was harder in 600 than it had been in 500. First of all, there was less commercial traffic to piggyback off of along the way. Second, the essential infrastructure of roads, bridges, canals, and ports was decaying. And finally, most of all, there were suddenly hard internal borders between kingdoms where there had once been, at most, checkpoints between provinces. I'll give you a few examples of this. I've mentioned Sidonius Apollinaris a few times in this show. He came up a lot in episode 7, the one on the transformations of Roman Gaul. Now, Sidonius was an aristocrat from the Auvergne region, the city of Clermont-Ferrand specifically, and he lived from around 430 to about 490. In other words, his life spanned the final transformation of the Roman Empire in the West to what came next, and he was a member of that last generation of the aristocracy to have anything like the kind of career that had been standard for a couple of hundred years. In his 20s, he briefly traveled from Gaul to Rome as part of the imperial court. He later served as prefect of the city of Rome, a really prestigious post, before finally returning home and becoming Bishop of Clermont. In that capacity, he defended the city of Clermont against the Goths, and he was exiled when the city fell, but finally he returned and occupied that post as bishop until he died, around 490. In Sidonius, we can see both sides of this divide. When we look at his letter collection, which spans most of his adult life, we can see the contraction of the Roman world happening in something like real time. He was born in or around Lyon, but received his education in Arles, and then spent time in Italy generally and Rome specifically on a couple of different occasions. He had contacts all over Gaul, from Provence in the south to Lyon, to Bordeaux, to Trier and Reims in the far north. This is exactly what you would expect for a well-connected aristocrat, for whom letters were the lifeblood of the social and political relationships that defined his status as an elite. One of the major parts of being a late Roman aristocrat was simply knowing, or being able to communicate with, other important people. Being able to tap into those networks through the medium of letters was in large part what made you important yourself, because you could leverage those contacts for the benefit of yourself and for the clients who were connected to you. If your idiot nephew needed a job, you could write to an imperial official and get him a post at court. If a slave ran away from your estate and ended up in Lyon, you could write to a city official to have your slave seized and brought back. If you needed marble for your personal bathhouse, you could write to a wealthy friend who owned a marble quarry. For Sidonius, those relationships, that whole network, spanned an entire region. There were no real barriers to communication for him. Wherever the Roman Empire went, so too could his letters. Over the course of his life, though, we can see that wide geographic distribution start to break down. His networks grew more and more restricted to the area around Clermont and other places within the emerging Visigothic kingdom in southern Gaul, and only rarely did they go beyond those boundaries. Now, Sidonius' cousin, Ruricius of Limoges, was a generation younger than his more famous relative. He never had the kinds of wide-ranging experiences that Sidonius did in his youth, when you could still travel a ways for education and maybe grab a job for a brief while at the center of power before eventually returning home. Ruricius' network of correspondence reflects this. He spent his entire life in the Visigothic kingdom of Aquitaine, residing in the city of Limoges and at an estate halfway between there and Toulouse in the southeast. Of all his surviving correspondence, only one letter, and even that is a maybe, traveled beyond the borders of the Visigothic kingdom. It's not like Ruricius was a humble, middle-class sort of guy, either. He was a bishop. He belonged to a blue-blooded aristocratic family, and he corresponded with all of the most important bishops and secular officials in the Visigothic kingdom. It's just that Ruricius's world ended with the boundaries of that kingdom, and that represents a huge shift from the world that Sidonius had grown up in. What changed? Well, over the course of Sidonius's life, a whole bunch of new political boundaries sprang up within what had once been Roman Gaul. Sure, there had been Franks in the north, Visigoths in Aquitaine, and Burgundians around Vienne and Geneva before, but they were, at least in theory, imperial allies. That theory became less and less tenable as the 450s turned into the 460s and beyond. It was clearer and clearer that central imperial authority simply wasn't coming back, and the kings of these emerging kingdoms started to act more like, well, kings in their own right and less like subordinates to an emperor who couldn't do anything anyway. That meant taking control of their territory and fighting wars against each other. So sure, there had been political instability before, and it's not like the installation of the Visigoths and the Burgundians within Roman territory had been the smoothest processes. Lots of aristocrats had pulled up stakes and headed for greener pastures at that point. This was a long-term process that took decades to fully play out, and the results were far more striking. Essentially, the second half of the 5th century saw the creation of real, internal borders where before there had been none. These new political borders between hostile kingdoms were a real barrier to communication. As far as I know, nobody has tried to look at the evidence for a trade and exchange through this lens, but from what I can tell, the evidence lines up right. Fewer and fewer kinds of regional potteries, not the still widely available African red slip that we've talked about before, but more local wares, of which there were a great many, had distributions that stretched beyond the boundaries of a single kingdom. The upshot here is that it got harder and harder to move, that people increasingly avoided crossing the boundaries between these new kingdoms. Now again, this doesn't mean that movement, trade, and communication stopped entirely, just that it got harder and harder to do so. And if something gets harder and harder to do, you're going to do less and less of it. Some of the letters talk about these increased risks and dangers associated with traveling. So here's one from Sidonius to his friend Faustus. Quote, "I think it is the wisest and safest course, especially between our two cities, far separated as they are, to renounce our rather too busy pens, putting off for a little while our diligent exchange of letters, and concerning ourselves instead with silence." End quote. Bishop Avitus of Vienne, a cousin of Sidonius and Ruricius, corresponded regularly with Sidonius' son in the early years of the 6th century. He was about a generation younger than Sidonius, a contemporary of his son. So when war broke out between the Visigoths and the Burgundians, Avitus expressed serious reservations about writing to Sidonius. Any letter he wrote would have to cross the boundaries between the two kingdoms and might put one or both of them in danger. And Sidonius's son did in fact come under suspicion at one point, in large part because of communications like this. There's a great quote from Sidonius Apollinaris that I think gets at the heart of this matter. Quote, "A courier can by no means pass the guards of the public high roads without strict scrutiny. He may indeed incur no danger, being free from guilt, but he usually experiences a great deal of difficulty, as the watchful searcher pries into every secret of the letter carriers, and if their answers to his questions should happen to show the least nervousness, they are believed to carry verbally, in their heads, the messages not committed to writing. Thus the man sent often suffers ill treatment, and the sender acquires an ill name, more particularly in these days when the established treaties of kingdoms, long jealous of one another, are made unstable by fresh conditions tending to produce discord." End quote. Now, who wants to put themselves and their letter carriers in danger just for the sake of maintaining a relationship with a distant cousin a few hundred miles away? That was the question that Sidonius and his later contemporaries had to answer, and they emphatically answered no, it wasn't worth it. It took only a couple of generations for the tightly connected Gallic aristocracy to fragment into local and regional branches. Even popes were constrained by these new political boundaries that rose up around the end of the 5th century. They had broad interests throughout the Mediterranean and regularly communicated with distant bishops and collections of bishops, but how far their programs extended depended a great deal on who controlled Rome at the time. When the Ostrogothic Kingdom of Italy briefly took control of Iberia in the 520s, for example, the popes suddenly started writing to correspondents in Iberia. When Rome was under control of the Eastern Empire, the popes mostly wrote to correspondents in territory controlled by the Eastern Empire. In Gregory the Great's letters, for example, you can literally trace the outlines of imperial territory and Lombard territory in Italy by looking at where he did and didn't write. He micromanaged the parts that were under imperial control and barely wrote at all to places under Lombard control. All of this was just a reflection, a superficial manifestation of the broader processes at work here, the uncoupling of the various places that had once been part of a tightly connected Roman world with its common culture, society, politics, and economy.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, 15% off your first order with code WONDERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Let's get out of the realm of these abstract shifts and talk about some of the real people and the journeys they took to some of the real places in this period before we move on to talking about places and the big picture. As I mentioned earlier, this was what fascinated me about these letters in the first place. They give us access to actual people, to lived experience, to the everyday kinds of journeys that people made from town to town and city to city. Here's one of my favorites. We already talked a bit about Ruricius, the Bishop of Limoges, and his somewhat restricted world. He had contacts all over the Visigothic kingdom, though, including a bunch in the Provence region around Arles. Now, there was a gentleman who regularly carried his correspondence, an elderly deacon named Capellutus, who seems to have traveled on a regular basis between Limoges and Provence. This Capellutus was an interesting guy. He came to the clergy late in life, but he was already tightly connected to some of the most important people in Provence, bishops of Nîmes and Arles. I'd say that's how he ended up carrying letters for them. He was a trusted, respected figure, and we can imagine this elderly man slowly trudging up the Roman road that ran parallel to the Rhône, and then along the pass that led from Lyon to Clermont to Limoges, a few servants or slaves in tow. Now, this particular incident has always spoken to me. In August of 599, Pope Gregory the Great wrote a sharp, angry letter to Bishop Constantius of Milan, a rather unsavory figure Gregory argued with and regularly reprimanded for his actions. The man who carried this letter, Philagrius, was blind. He had made the journey all the way from Milan to Rome, a 10-day trip even on horseback and much longer on foot, to plead his case to Gregory. To get from Milan to Rome, Philagrius had to cross from territory controlled by the Lombards into imperial territory, then back again, explaining himself and his mission to suspicious, short-tempered Lombard and imperial soldiers. He had to cross the Apennines, the great mountains running across the spine of Italy, and wind his way through the malarial valley of the Tiber at the height of summer. Constantius's agents were harassing him, Philagrius said, trying to seize his property and generally making nuisances of themselves, and he begged Gregory to intercede on his behalf. Gregory agreed, and excoriated Constantius for his lack of charity to the afflicted. Philagrius returned home, crossing again through imperial territory into Lombard territory to imperial territory and finally back to Lombard territory with his precious letter in hand. Now let me tell you about a more epic journey, a desperate one undertaken by a pair of diplomatic envoys who were desperately trying to stave off an impending war between the Visigoths and the aggressive king of the Franks, Clovis. In the waning days of summer in 506, a Roman aristocrat named Cinarius and his unnamed companion, presumably another aristocrat, set off from the Ostrogothic kingdom of Italy to Gaul. Cinarius was already an experienced hand at these kinds of things, and by the end of his life, he would count more than 25 embassies to foreign kings and emperors on his resume. First, Cinarius and his compatriot, presumably along with an entourage of slaves, servants, and other functionaries, set off for the court of the Visigothic king Alaric II in Toulouse. They probably hopped on one of the many merchant ships still putting into the port of Rome and crossed the open sea from there to Narbonne. From Narbonne, they turned inland, heading west toward Carcassonne with the sharp southern edge of the Massif Central rising to their right in the distance beyond the Aude River and the foothills of the Pyrenees to their left. After Carcassonne and crossing the Aude, the landscape flattened into rolling hills as they turned to the northwest and to Toulouse. We don't know what kind of reception Cinarius and his companion received from Alaric II, but their journey didn't end there. From Toulouse, they headed back to the coast and then hopped on a coastal ship that took them from Narbonne to Arles, and from there they headed up the Rhone to the city of Vienne, the capital of the Burgundian kingdom, where they could find their king, Gundobad. Gundobad apparently agreed to their terms and suggestions, and a source written shortly after this describes the Burgundians as locked in, quote, a perpetual alliance with the Ostrogoths. From Vienne, Cinarius and his companion headed into wilder territory, passing beyond the former boundaries of the Roman Empire and into Barbaricum, where they met the kings of the Heruli, Thuringi, and Varni in the hopes of negotiating an alliance to put pressure on the king of the Franks, Clovis. Finally, Cinarius and his companion headed back into what had once been Roman territory, making for the city of Paris and the court of King Clovis. They made their pitch, and as they left the city and headed south through Orléans, Autun, and back into Burgundian territory, they must have thought their last-ditch plea to avoid war had been successful. Clovis's army didn't march that fall, and for a little while at least, peace managed to reign. Cinarius and the other envoy headed back down the Rhone to Arles, and then caught a merchant ship back to Rome. A short, quick journey across the Apennines brought them to the Ostrogothic court at Ravenna, where they delivered their final report to King Theodoric. Whew, that's a journey. Cinarius and his companions passed through 7 different kingdoms, traversed the entirety of Gaul, and went beyond the boundaries of what had once been the Roman Empire. They traveled by ship, by road, and by boat. This must have taken them no fewer than 4 months, and probably much, much longer. It's worth thinking for a moment about the context of that travel, though. While the two of them were official travelers, there was no more cursus publicus, there were no handy way stations where they could stop and change horses. Many of the roads and bridges they passed over would have been crumbling from lack of maintenance, though a few barbarian kings did very occasionally make repairs to infrastructure. Ports like Arles would have been beginning to silt up or otherwise fall into disrepair. Now these are just a few of the people, and a few of the journeys, that we can meet and see through the thousands of letters in this period. Individually, they may be interesting, but they don't tell us that much. In the aggregate, though, we can see much broader patterns of mobility and communications. It's with those patterns, and how they compare to what we see in other source bases like pottery, that I want to end today's episode. Mostly, I want to talk about places. I want to talk about the patterns of connections that existed between them in this post-imperial world, and how those patterns had changed from the time of the empire. 2 cities stand out head and shoulders above the rest from the evidence of the letters, Rome and Constantinople. These 2 cities were the central points to which traffic and correspondence flowed from all corners of the Mediterranean world and far beyond. While calling Rome even a shadow of its former self is an insult to shadows everywhere, it was still the home of the Pope and a wealthy regional aristocracy. Given that so many of our letters are focused around ecclesiastical matters, it makes sense that Rome would pop up so often. As we talked about in the last episode, on the fall of the economy, there were still enough people living in Rome for it to be a legitimate center of commercial demand as well. Now, Constantinople, of course, was the center of the Eastern Roman Empire, the most powerful political unit going. It had hundreds of thousands of inhabitants, it sat at the junction of numerous trade routes, and it was an important religious center as well. In network terms, at the broadest levels, the trans-Mediterranean level, Rome and Constantinople are nodes, the location of important strategic functions, political, cultural, social, religious, and economic. Other cities acted as nodes in smaller, regional networks. Ravenna in Italy, Carthage in North Africa, and Metz in Eastern Gaul all fall into this category. Ravenna was the center of first the Ostrogothic, and then Eastern Roman rule in Italy. Carthage was the center of the Vandal Kingdom, and then the Eastern Roman province in North Africa, and Metz became the capital of one of the Frankish kingdoms in Gaul. Now, they were important in different ways, mind you. Carthage was the most important economic center of the three, while Ravenna and Metz were more politically oriented, but all three of them sucked in communications and, more generally, people from elsewhere. Now, finally, we have hubs. In network terms, hubs aren't necessarily the places where important strategic functions occur, though they can do that too. We should think of hubs more as exchangers, the places where different routes meet and travelers can transfer from one to the next. Arles, in southern Gaul, is the quintessential hub. It's where the sea routes from North Africa, Italy, and Iberia met the roadways from the interior of Gaul and the coastal roads that ran along the Mediterranean. For good measure, it also sat at the mouth of the Rhone, the major north-south river in eastern Gaul. Another example of this kind of place is Salona, in modern-day Croatia next to today's city of Split along the coast of the Adriatic. Salona was where the sea routes of the Mediterranean and Adriatic met the roadways that led into the Balkans. One final example of a hub is Syracuse in Sicily, where a variety of sea routes from the eastern and western Mediterranean converged, along with roadways from the interior of Sicily and local trade routes from the Bay of Naples and the Adriatic coast of Italy. These were all places that appeared over and over and over again across different collections of letters separated by as much as 150 years. They match up neatly with what we'd expect from the evidence of exchange networks, though with a few surprises. We'd expect Marseille to figure more heavily, while Arles and Salona are somewhat surprising inclusions. Metz, too, appears to be of outsized importance, according to the letters. Where letters didn't go is just as interesting, and those patterns, too, reinforce the impression that we get from other bodies of evidence. Northern Gaul was completely cut off from broader networks of communication, with only scattered letters going there throughout this period, just as we'd expect from the archaeological record of trade. Britain is a completely blank spot until Gregory the Great's mission to the Anglo-Saxons at the beginning of the 7th century. The interior of Iberia had always been isolated and grew even more so. Letters speak to that, too. Letters aren't a perfect body of evidence, but they do tell us a great deal about the depth and extent of movement and communication, and they can speak to the connections in places that haven't been well excavated or from which not much material evidence from this period survives. I only really hit the high points here, but letters do tell us a great deal about places whose connections to the broader world we'd never know about otherwise. So why does this matter? Why should we pay attention to letters, to communication, to mobility in general? It was because these routes, these places, and the movement between them were the building blocks of a whole cultural, social, political, and economic world. The contraction of these networks of communication that we can see in the letters is just a proxy marker, the canary in a coal mine, for this larger unraveling of the Roman world. No matter how screwed up it might have been, in 450 there was still a recognizably Roman world throughout most of what had been the Western Empire, excepting Northern Gaul and Britain. By 600, that world was completely gone. Only the biggest and most important places still had real connections to a broader world. In essence, the world that replaced the Roman world was a fragmented, regional, and even local one. Consider language as one aspect of this shift. In 400, the spoken Latin of the Western Empire was remarkably homogeneous. A Roman born in Britain could easily understand one born and raised in the Balkans or North Africa, and one raised in Gaul wouldn't have any problems communicating with someone from Italy or Spain. Why? Movement. Constant movement. If 40% of the population moved some substantial distance from their place of birth over the course of their lives, if a constant stream of soldiers, merchants, government officials, and other travelers moved from place to place, then there was a constant leveling effect, called koineization, on the regional dialects of the empire. 200 years later, that was no longer the case. Only churchmen were speaking Latin in Britain, if even them, while British had made a comeback and Anglo-Saxon was on the rise. Frankish had spread all across the North Sea coast of the continent and beyond. Slavic had started to make its way into the Balkans. Everybody elsewhere still thought they spoke Latin, but the dialects had diverged. Someone born near Paris would have had a great deal of trouble understanding someone from Italy or Spain, let alone somebody from Dacia. Language is just one example of this. We could say the same thing about writing practices, about pottery making, about politics, religion, anything. When the movement stopped, so too did the broad currents of common practice and belief that had tied together the distant corners of the Roman world into something like a unity. Sure, the Roman world had been diverse, with its own regional manifestations of trans-regional trends, its own distinct regional cultures and practices, but it still had been recognizably Roman, even if being Roman inherently meant being cosmopolitan. To be Roman was to be mobile, to move easily from place to place within this diverse world. In 400, you could have been a Roman in Britain, Gaul, Spain, Italy, North Africa, the Balkans, even the Greek-speaking East. In 600, that was no longer the case. This, to me, was the defining change that went along with the fall of the Roman Empire, and letters are essential for understanding that process. Now, I hope this dive into a real specialist topic has been worthwhile for you all, and I really enjoyed getting to share some of my own original research with you. In the next several episodes, we'll shift our focus toward politics, something we probably haven't talked about enough in a show about the fall of the Roman Empire. First, we'll go over a broad narrative of the collapse of the Western Imperial State in the 5th century, and then we'll move from there to talk about the barbarian successor kingdoms and how they functioned. Was there anything still Roman about these post-Roman states? That's what we'll talk about for the next several episodes. Thank you for joining me for today's show. If you have a spare moment, I'd really appreciate it if you left a rating and a review on the platform of your choice. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, concerns, or if you just want to chat about the fall of the Roman Empire, drop me a line anytime. If you want to help me out even a bit more, I'd appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's WONDERY/survey. If you're looking for more history podcasts, check out History Matters on iTunes and SoundCloud. A historian friend of mine and I, Keith Plimers, are talking about present-day issues in historical perspective, tackling topics like political breakdown, settlement patterns, globalization, and much, much more. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.